The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
That was wonderful.
My pleasure.
Don't get me wrong, Jean-Luc, but I'm glad we're not joined at the hip any longer.
So, were you getting tired of my company?
Just tired of bumping into you every 30 seconds. I was beginning to feel as if you were part of my uniform.
To freedom.
Freedom.
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, June the 12th, 2024. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing. It's Just Right.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
The word freedom is much revered, but little understood. In our show opener, borrowed from Star Trek The Next Generation, it's important to recognize that in making their toast to freedom, Beverly Crusher and Jean-Luc Picard were, in fact, celebrating their freedom from each other. And this strikes at the heart of the experience and meaning of freedom more than any quote-unquote right-wing conceptualizations of freedom can do. Now, the political polarity associated with freedom is called the right. But there have been numerous variants of what is called the right, using labels like far right, extreme right, center right, alt right, conservative, libertarian, anarchist, government minimalist, etc., and most of these could in turn fall under the category of right wing. Bear in mind that I regard each of those categories as actually being on the left, and therein lies my thesis for this week, in which I will attempt to argue and illustrate why I think the right wing, as distinct from the right, is dangerously flying blind. And this is particularly relevant given the recent developments around Donald Trump's conviction in a New York court, preceded by his appearance at a Libertarian Party convention. The latter, I think, is the more significant event with regard to our conversation today. And then, of course, there were the incredible quote-unquote right-wing electoral victories in Europe this past week. So for the right, the real challenge now begins. And the real question behind that challenge is this. Can the right wing remain united enough and principled enough to actually move things in the right direction? Towards freedom instead of away from it? Or is the woke ideology really the only thing that the right wing is united against? Our attempt to address that challenge begins right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback at justrightmedia.org, hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave, follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because, as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Now, as you no doubt may have noticed, we begin every episode of our broadcast with the distinction that this show is not right wing, but just right. A wing is associated with a body. That body could be a bird, a building, a plane, or in today's context, the body politic, being the political zeitgeist of the given day. I'm concerned that one of the most dangerous and destructive trends on the right today is the growing belief and assumption that left and right don't matter anymore because all of the major political parties are indistinguishable from each other. Now, while that is undoubtedly true about the parties, the cynicism about the labels left and right is based on ignorance, I'm afraid to say. Ignorance about what ideas are on the left and what ideas are on the right. Because by definition, left and right represent polarities. That means that one is the opposite of the other. That's what those words are supposed to mean. But for some reason, it never seems to occur to those who dismiss the labels left and right, that the sameness that they perceive in all of the parties is the fact that irrespective of what those parties call themselves, they are all on one side of the political polarity, and that's the left. In the same way that the Republican Party has members and representatives who have been labeled RINOs, R-I-N-O, Republicans in name only, so too have many right-wing parties repeatedly demonstrated themselves to be RINOs as well, R-I-N-O, only this time it stands for right in name only. The actual polarity of the right has all but been abandoned, save for a very few advocates in the political and philosophical arena. Now, about half a century ago, Ayn Rand defined the terms rightist and leftist like this, quote, "Since today there are no clear definitions of political terms, I use the word rightist to denote the views of those who are predominantly in favor of individual freedom and capitalism, and the word leftist to denote the views of those who are predominantly in favor of government controls and socialism," end quote. So sounds like she got it just right. And note that she described rightist and leftist as descriptions of the views and not necessarily the people identified as such. So basically that's a good framework from which to construct our discussion today. And as for socialism being identified on the left, I'm going to use the term socialism to denote all of its variants. That means socialism, communism, fascism, collectivism, democratic socialism, anarchy, and yes, libertarianism, and probably many others of lesser known movements. And that would include movements like feminism and environmentalism, which would also qualify as being variants of socialism. And for the most part today, my harshest criticisms and warnings will be directed towards many of the ideas expressed by people generally identified on the right or on the right wing. Many of these people I fully support in their broader efforts, and some are my own friends and acquaintances. So please don't assume that on the grounds of my criticisms today, that we haven't in the past, and will again in the future, feature these same people when we would be in complete agreement and support of what they might be expressing. With rare exceptions, attacking the message rather than the messenger is always the preferred way to go. Which brings us to our first focus of the day. Trump's recent conviction on all counts of, you know, who knows what, has been absorbing the attention and time of most of the bloggers on the right that I've watched over the past week or two. But that conviction of Trump was, in my humble opinion, just another blip in terms of the bigger picture of the tyranny that wants to destroy Western culture. A far more significant event regarding Trump happened about a week earlier, when he, and I have to say, very much to his credit, appeared before a libertarian convention to appeal to libertarians, whom he and many others mistakenly perceive as being on the right. One of the best descriptions and commentaries on Trump's speech to the libertarian convention was presented by Mark Dice on his May 27th show, mostly because he raised a number of issues that I intend to address. So on this side of our upcoming bumper, we'll be hearing the essence of Mark's observations, while on the return side of the bumper, we'll be hearing from Matt Walsh's May 31st commentary on Trump's guilt.
On Saturday, Donald Trump walked into the Lion's Den speaking in person at the Libertarian Convention, one of the third-party political groups like the Green Party that has, you know, just a tiny, tiny fraction of people who are disaffected and just not satisfied with the Republicans or the Democrats. And while the liberal media is celebrating this and trying to make fun of him, because at times he did get booed by some of the attendees, I'll play you some of the clips in a moment, this was actually a brilliant and bold move. Trump met with boos, asking libertarians for nomination and votes at chaotic convention, reports ABC, always broadcasting crap. Matt Drudge probably came up with this headline when he was hanging out at a gay bathhouse in Thailand somewhere. Booed, heckled at Libertarian Convention. The Don loses control. The video MAGA doesn't want you to see. Oh, really? Well, let's take a look at this clip then, shall we? The full clip in its full context, not just the first half, which is the only part that's being circulated by the liberal media and Matt Drudge.
The Libertarian Party should nominate Trump for President of the United States. Whoa.
It's a mix of cheers and boos. To be expected. So that's the part that the liberal media is circulating. That's the part they clipped and are trying to make go viral on social media. But here is the second half they don't want you to see.
Thank you. No, only do that if you want to win. If you want to lose, don't do that. Keep getting your 3% every 4 years. The reasons for doing so.
Keep getting your 3%, he says. And that wasn't in the script. That was him pushing back. And again, this hostility was to be expected. And the sad truth that the libertarian voters don't want to know is they are throwing their vote away, as this very basic comic illustrates. Today I will vote for third party. And then the Democrat wins by that margin, and then they take away your guns. Libertarians are a very unique bunch. Generally, they believe in maximum freedom or individual sovereignty, which also usually means like no taxes, because in their view, the government taxing people is forcing them to engage in a behavior that they're not volunteering into. And that's a violation of the non-aggressive principle and the free market. And they come up with all of these convoluted rabbit hole philosophical arguments about how they believe society would still somehow function under their worldview, when in reality, they mean well and they're nice people, but they are just pipe dreaming. Now, that's not to say I don't agree with all of their points that could actually practically be applied. They have a lot more in common with us than they do with the Democrats. They believe in the Second Amendment. They don't believe in foreign intervention and giving our tax dollars to foreign countries. And so there's definitely way more overlap with traditional conservatives or Republicans than there are with the Marxist Democrats and the Libertarians. Which is why Donald Trump went there to try to convince them not to throw their vote away this election.
Our rights and freedoms have never been more in danger than they are right now. That is why I have come to extend a hand of friendship to ask for your partnership to defeat communism, defeat Marxism, and defeat crooked Joe Biden, who is destroying our country. He's destroying our country.
Nobody certainly disagrees with that. So what's it going to be, libertarians? And remember, perfect is the enemy of good. Is Donald Trump perfect? No. Even if you don't think he's good, you certainly got to admit that he is at least okay, especially compared to the alternative leader. And this is who the Libertarian Party nominated over the weekend as their presidential nominee. Of course he's gay. And quadruple vaxxed and proud to wear his mask. I'm sorry, but if you vote for this clown or the Libertarian Party, you are just as bad as the Marxist Democrats.
Today on the Matt Walsh Show, justice is officially dead in this country as Donald Trump is convicted by a kangaroo court in one of the most disgraceful sham trials in American history. I have plenty to say about this today, as you can imagine. Donald Trump, as you have certainly heard by now, has been convicted. The verdict is in, guilty. Guilty on all 34 felony counts of running for re-election. Because that, after all, is the actual crime that Trump committed. It's the one and only reason that this case was ever brought. They prosecuted him for trying to be president again. That's the actual reality. That's the real crime, which isn't a crime. But you might still be wondering, on paper, what crime was Trump just convicted of? Somehow, a day after the guilty verdict was read, the actual crime he was guilty of is still very hard to say. Now, one possible theory is that the government of New York really doesn't like it when people overpay their taxes. They're the first government in the history of the universe that actively punishes its citizens for handing over too much cash. It drives Alvin Bragg absolutely crazy when that happens, apparently. If New Yorkers pay the government too much cash, then the full weight of New York's criminal justice system will come crashing down on them. A jury will convict them in a day, and they'll face several years in prison. This is how desperately New York doesn't want money from its citizens. Now, that's what you have to believe if, for some reason, you're still pretending that there was any legitimacy to the show trial of Donald Trump that concluded yesterday in Manhattan. I've been thinking of the best way to illustrate just how unprecedented and disgraceful the trial was. There are so many possibilities to choose from. But I keep coming back to this one point because nobody else is really talking about it. And it puts this whole debacle into perspective. In order to convict Donald Trump, it was not enough to show that he had supposedly falsified a business record. The government also had to show that Trump had falsified those records in furtherance of some other crime. But what was the other crime? We made it all the way to closing arguments, and still the prosecution had never explained what the crime was that the defendant had supposedly committed. But during those closing arguments this week, a prosecutor named Joshua Steinglass finally offered a theory. He said that Donald Trump had falsified the business records in order to violate a different New York state law that prohibited the use of unlawful means to promote any candidate for office. But that still leaves a key question unanswered. What were those unlawful means that Trump supposedly engaged in? So you keep peeling the onion back to find what the hell crime Trump is supposed to have committed, and you continue to come up empty. So Steinglass didn't say definitely what the unlawful means were, but he did mention a few possibilities. And one of those possibilities was that Trump had violated New York tax law. Now, when you hear that, you might think, well, they're alleging that Trump is engaging in tax evasion. But they're actually alleging the opposite. They're accusing Trump of not evading taxes. Specifically, Steinglass argued that Trump's 1099 form was inaccurate because the payment to Michael Cohen was actually a reimbursement and not compensation, as the Trump Organization had reported it. But if that were the case, then the government, under its own theory of how Trump's team should have filed the paperwork, would be getting less money out of the deal because they're not owed income tax on reimbursements. They're only owed income tax on compensation. Now, I went through the transcripts and found the quote from the prosecutor because when I heard about it, I couldn't believe it was real, but it is. Here's what he told the jury. Quote, "It's true that the result of this improper accounting is that the taxes would have to be paid that weren't owed. You don't have to pay taxes on a reimbursement. So the result of reporting them as income tax is more taxes are getting paid than are owed. But as the judge will tell you, it's a crime to prepare false tax documents, regardless, even when doing so, does not result in the underpayment of taxes." With the Trump trial, the left has trampled every norm that exists in the criminal justice system. They prosecuted the leading presidential candidate in an election year for a 7-year-old fake crime. They assigned a hack judge to the case who essentially guided the jury to a conviction. And they did it all in front of a jury in one of the most partisan places in the country.
The real crime was the institution of income tax in the first place. But I'm getting ahead of myself here, because that's a subject for another day. But the quick digest goes like this. Income and property taxes do not have a place in a free society. Only consumption and sales taxes can be justified in a free society. And I'm guessing that most libertarians would not agree with me on this. With regard to Trump's kangaroo convictions, I was reminded of yet another quote written by Murray Hopper of the Freedom Party of Ontario. Quote, "The rich in our society must feel like the character in the Kafka play who was found guilty of being innocent, especially if their wealth resulted from business activity," end quote. And in referring to Trump's post-verdict comments, Glenn Beck had this to say.
He not only called Biden stupid and worse, the worst president we've ever had, he referred to the president and those who are in the administration as fascists, which I thought was really strong language and appropriate, but shocking to hear.
It'll be shocking for many people on the left that don't even know the definition of that word, that have been throwing it around willy-nilly.
Yeah.
To hear that about themselves.
Yeah.
I hope there's a little bit of self-reflection.
Yeah, there won't be.
There won't be.
But the definition of a fascist is an authoritarian state that partners with corporations and the media to control. And that's exactly what we're doing. It's exactly what Biden is doing. He is technically 100% accurate on his labeling of this administration fascistic.
Yes, Trump was 100% accurate in labeling his political opponents fascist. And for Glenn to describe an authoritarian state that partners with corporations and the media fascist, he is correct. But as a definition of fascism itself, his description was woefully incomplete and does not define the fundamental nature of fascism. And nor do most dictionaries. For example, Funken-Wagnalls describes fascism this way, quote, a one-party system of government in which the individual is subordinated to the state and control is maintained by military force, secret police, rigid censorship, and government regimentation of industry and finance, end quote. While the American College Dictionary defines fascism as, quote, a governmental system with strong centralized power, permitting no opposition or criticism, controlling all affairs of the nation, industrial, commercial, etc., and emphasizing an aggressive nationalism, end quote. Well, both of these dictionaries, like Glenn Beck, have indeed described a condition of fascism, but failed to define the word itself, as in, what distinguishes fascism from other tyrannical forms of government? Each of those dictionary definitions of fascism could just as accurately have been describing a condition of socialism or communism. Same difference. Descriptions are not definitions. So we turned our attention to the master of epistemology, Ayn Rand herself, and she had this to say about fascism, and I quote, the difference between socialism and fascism is superficial and purely formal, but it is significant psychologically. It brings the authoritarian nature of a planned economy crudely into the open. The main characteristic of socialism and communism is public ownership of the means of production, and therefore the abolition of private property. Under fascism, citizens retain responsibilities of owning property without freedom to act and without any of the advantages of ownership. Under both systems, sacrifice is invoked as a magic, omnipotent solution to any crisis, and the public good is the altar on which its victims are immolated, end quote. And for an example of this magic solution, consider the Protect Granny and 2 weeks to flatten the curve propaganda during the fake pandemic. Individuals were forced to sacrifice for the public good. And since Rand argued that any differences between socialism and fascism are superficial, maybe we should take a look at the definition of socialism while we're at it. Funken-Wagnalls describes socialism as, quote, public collective ownership or control of the basic means of production, distribution, and exchange, with the avowed aim of operating for use rather than for profit, and of assuring to each member of society an equitable share of the goods, services, etc., end quote. Well, that is a perfect description of the quote-unquote circular economy that Canada's plastic registry bureaucrats intend to work towards, as we discovered recently on a past broadcast of this show. Now, socialism, as defined in the Ayn Rand lexicon, reads thusly, quote, socialism is the doctrine that man has no right to exist for his own sake, that his life and his work do not belong to him but to society, and that society may dispose of him in any way it pleases for the sake of whatever it deems to be its own tribal collective good, end quote. Well, socialism sounds an awful lot like fascism to me, and it sounds like what's happening in the West today, doesn't it? In this context, there are a couple of other definitions that I think require clarification. The definitions of public ownership and the definition of fascism as a public-private partnership with the state. Public ownership is a myth. There's no such thing. When people use the term public to describe ownership, what they really mean, but refuse to say, is government, as in government ownership. I mean, each of us is a member of the public, but we own nothing and we're outrageously happy about it, aren't we? Just try selling your shares of the public street that's out in front of your house. You can't do it. The myth of public ownership is so stupid that to anyone who believes in public ownership, I've got a proposition. I got a bridge to sell you in Brooklyn. Oh, but wait, you already own the Brooklyn Bridge, don't you? In your mind. In the same way, there's no such thing as a public-private partnership with the state, as fascism has been described. Again, the word public in this phrase is a euphemism for the state, and a partnership between a private interest with the state is a metaphysical impossibility. And why do I say this? Because the word partner denotes equality in power and equality in decision-making, and it also implies consent. But in this partnership, it's the partner with the gun who has all the power, the legal right to use force, that calls all the shots, no matter how much it might appear otherwise. So the partner with the gun is the boss, and the private partners just follow orders. Now, shifting back to the libertarian question in all of this, I have to begin by strongly disagreeing with Mark Dice's theory of the quote-unquote wasted vote. He cites Trump's criticisms of the libertarians when he talks about them getting 3% every 4 years, and then goes on to perpetuate one of the most destructive myths about voting in democracy. The sad truth that libertarian voters don't want to know is that they're throwing away their votes, as illustrated in a cartoon where one party wins over another by the margin of votes cast for a third party, and then the Democrat wins by that margin. Well, I've had this BS argument shoved in my face since the first day we established the Freedom Party of Ontario. Think about what that means in practice. Given the overwhelming popularity of Trump, and given all of the polls saying that he's way ahead of his opponents, that would mean that all votes not cast for Trump would be quote-unquote wasted votes. Whether you vote Democrat, Green, Libertarian, or for the Capitalist Party, that vote is wasted, thrown away because your vote wasn't cast for the winner. And yes, that's as stupid as it sounds. You know, I have a great suspicion that this very myth is what keeps most registered voters from showing up to vote on Election Day. If they don't support the presumed winning candidate, they see their vote as wasted in any case, so why bother to show up to vote in the first place? The only time a voter is throwing his or her vote away is when they're voting against someone or something instead of for someone or something that is otherwise available. Here in Canada, many predict that Pierre Poilievre and the CPC, the Conservative Party of Canada, will theoretically win the next election and defeat Trudeau. I would argue that anyone who supports freedom and votes for CPC instead of PPC, the People's Party of Canada, is throwing their vote away even if their candidate may win in a given riding. If you vote libertarian, you are just as bad as the Marxist Democrats, says Mark Dice. But only moments before arriving at that conclusion, he pointed out that the libertarian movement overlaps with conservatives and Republicans, and that libertarians have more in common with them than with Democrats, Marxists, and the left. See the problem here? Those two observations either represent a contradiction or a consistency. The contradiction lies in the assumption that conservatives and Marxists are opposites of each other. And if so, how can you reconcile that voting for libertarians is equivalent to voting for Marxist Democrats if at the same time libertarians have more in common with conservatives and Republicans? And the consistency in that argument is, namely, that conservatives and Republicans are just as bad as Marxist Democrats. Really, it doesn't matter which one you pick, because each interpretation leads us to the same conclusion. Now, our next pair of audio bites have a special significance for me personally, because I have known and interacted with most of the people speaking or being spoken about. On this side of our upcoming bumper, Michael Malice in conversation with Walter Block regarding Walter's personal experiences with Ayn Rand and Murray Rothbard. On the return side, it's Laura Lynn Tyler Thompson in conversation with the leader of the People's Party of Canada, Maxime Bernier.
We have with us a legend and an icon, Walter Block. Walter is the author of over 24 books, including Defending the Undefendable. You've written literally hundreds of peer-reviewed articles. You're an economics professor at Loyola. You were converted to libertarianism and anarchism by Ayn Rand and Murray Rothbard personally. And now at the tender age of 82, you have been evicted from libertarianism by the king of libertarianism, Hans Hermann Hoppe. Get out, go back to Scotland. Now I'm assuming, because of your support of Israel, I'm assuming you're going to join the ADL and the Democratic Socialists of America, where you belong. Get the F out. I really try to avoid having libertarians on the show whenever possible, but I do love drama. So I'm like, all right, let's get Walter on. So let's start talking about Rand, because she was always described as being very intimidating in person. And I'm sure as a kid, meeting Ayn Rand was a very big deal at the time. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, let me give you a little bit of background. I overlapped with Bernie Sanders 4 years in Madison High School and 1 year at Brooklyn College. And we were on the track team together. We were sort of buddies, and my views and his were indistinguishable. I was a sort of pinko commie socialist like he is. I changed a bit. He didn't. Then what happened is Ayn Rand came to Brooklyn College to speak, and I came to boo and hiss her. And this was, 1950, maybe 1961, something like
wait,
that.
Wait, you actually went there with the intention of being this obnoxious college kid who's going to put her in her place?
No. It's a little different. Nowadays, when you are obnoxious, what you do is you prevent them from speaking. In those days, it was much more, I don't know what, polite. Namely, you would have a slight little boo or a hiss when she said something that capitalism is great, and then she could speak. So there was no interference. It was just I and all the other commie socialists were exhibiting our disagreement with capitalism. But it was done politely. This was a very different epoch than nowadays when, you know, when Charles Murray comes to speak, you don't let him speak and you try right. to physically abuse him. Okay, so I sat through the speech, and at the end of the speech, they announced that the Ayn Rand Study Club that had invited her to speak was having a lunch in her honor, and anyone could come. And I wanted to convert her to socialism. So I came to the lunch, and it was a long, long table, maybe 50 people on each side, and she was sitting at the head of the table, and the only empty seats were way at the other end of the table. And I sat down and I said, you know, socialism is the way to go to my neighbor, and he, and capitalism is evil. And he said, well, you know, I don't really know all that much about it, but the people who do are at the other end of the table. So I went to the other end of the table and I stuck my head in between Ayn's and...
Wait, hold on. I got to interrupt because I just love this like chutzpah. Right, which I can relate to as a Brooklyn Jewish kid from back in the day, that you're like, this Ayn Rand lady, she doesn't know what's up. I'm going to sit her down and she's going to get a lesson and her head's going to spin and she's going to thank me for saving her from her evil stupidity. That was the mindset, yes?
Roughly, yes. No, not roughly, exactly. We're both Brooklyn Jewish kids, so we are on the same wavelength. So I okay. stuck my head between Ayn's and Nathan's, and the other people were there, Leonard Peikoff and Alan Greenspan and the whole gang there. And Brandon was very, very nice. He said, look, there's no room at the table here for you to sit, but I'll come to the other end of the table and I'll talk to you under two conditions. One condition is you don't allow this to lapse with one discussion, but we keep going until we settle this.
Oh.
And I agreed. And the second one is I have to read two books. One was Atlas Shrugged and the other was Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. And I read the books and I couldn't put Atlas Shrugged down. I mean, I still think that's the best novel ever written. I'm a big fan of Atlas Shrugged.
I know. The Fountainhead's a better novel.
Okay, well, we can agree to disagree on that. Yeah. You're objectively wrong.
Are you going to sit me down and educate me like you did, Miss Rand?
So I went to Brandon's house. I went to Rand's house.
Wait.
And four or five times, and I read the books, and I was converted. I was not a Randian. I never understood their metaphysics and epistemology and all that, and why Beethoven was evil. I never could understand that.
Mozart was evil. Beethoven was good, I think.
No. Beethoven was evil, and Mozart was a red.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I was not a Randian in that sense, but I certainly agreed with their economics. Henry Hazlitt really knocked me for a loop. And then what happened is I went to the NBI, the Nathaniel Brandon Institute, and Ayn Rand and Brandon were very, very nice to new beginners.
Wow. Okay.
Like me. They were very sweet, very kind. And, you know, I was a Bernie Sanders type socialist, and they invited me to their houses and they would talk to me, and it was very lovely. Then I went to the Nathaniel Brandon Institute, and it was very different. This was supposedly for people who were already cognoscenti on the objectivism. And if you asked Ayn Rand a question after her lecture, like a softball question, like on page 42 of this, you said that, could you elaborate? That would be fine. But if you said on page 42, you said this, and on page 93, you said that, and I see a contradiction, you know what she would do?
What?
She would kick you out of the meeting. I mean, this was just amazing.
Wait, seriously?
She would literally say, get out, and you're off the mailing list. And
in those words?
Yeah, specifically, yes, explicitly. And this was cultish. I mean, you know, if you disagree with her, I mean, this is a polite question.
Hold on, let me ask. Hold on, because it's not even disagreeing with her. Because I could agree with your conclusion and say, hey, help me understand, help me reconcile these two things. They seem contradictory to me. That's not even disagreeing. That's saying, explain it to me. Or even if you did disagree, it's just like, I think, you know what it is? I know how Ayn Rand thinks. I think what she's perceiving is her you saying you're wrong. And you don't realize you're wrong. So it's doubly an insult in her mind.
Yeah.
So that's why she's like, this is my house. You don't come here to tell me I'm wrong. Come here to learn, I think was her mindset.
I think you're absolutely right. But that was just for the cognoscenti who were in. Whereas if it's a totally new person and you said something like that, she would be very gentle. So it was sort of a schizophrenic, a different way of dealing with people. Very strange. Well, then to continue my odyssey, I was now a limited government libertarian.
Right.
And I now found myself at Columbia University. And Larry Moss, a fellow student of mine, said, you must meet Murray Rothbard. He's an anarchist. And I said, anarchist? I don't want to meet an anarchist because, you know, anarchism is crazy. The big problem with Murray that I had was laughing. I mean, you get stomach cramps from laughing. I mean, he was just so funny. And he converted me into anarchism in about 10 minutes. He said, look, you believe in privatizing the post office, and here are the Hazlitt reasons. And you believe in, you know, privatizing public libraries, and here are the reasons, and the sanitation. Well, why not the cops? Why not privatize courts and talk about private courts? And the light bulb went over my head, and I was now sort of a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist. But Murray has been a major influence. He was my mentor, my friend, and I revere him in many, many ways. But, you know, Murray was not a cultist. I must have, 10 disagreements with Murray on immigration, on abortion, on voluntary slavery. And he never even came within a million miles of breaking with me just because we disagreed on something.
Pierre Poilievre, he should be speaking out for the conservatives in this nation, but he doesn't have the courage to talk like this.
No, like he didn't have the courage also to speak against COVID-19 and for freedom of choice during the COVID hysteria. You know, Pierre is not a leader, he's following the woke ideology, and that's what he's doing right now. Because if you don't speak against that and you're silent, you know, that means you are for it. So just the fact that he's not speaking against it, and that means that, you know, like all these establishment politicians, he is not ready to do the right thing for Canadians. So now everybody must wake up and look at what happened to us. So I don't like that here in Canada, we try to turn the page and no, everything was okay. We must have a parliamentary committee that will question everything that happened to us during COVID-19. And you can count on me to be sure that we'll have that process in this country. It can be in a year, it can be 2 years, but yes, we need to have a process like they're doing in US right now.
What would happen if you, with the PPC, were able to get 2 or 3 members into parliament? How would that help Canada?
That will, because our goal is to change the discussion, the national discussion. But I'm pretty sure all time will come. I don't know when, but it will, because the common sense will always prevail.
So what do you say to those who say, well, we can't vote for you, Max. We hate Trudeau. So we just got to get Trudeau out. You know, we'll get you next time, but we just got to get Trudeau out. What do you say to them?
I'll be able to say to Canadians, look, you can have a win. You see, you look at the polls, Poilievre will win, so you're going to get rid of Trudeau. Now you can vote for your values. You will need us to keep Poilievre in the right direction, to keep Poilievre honest. And yes, we will support Poilievre when he will be a conservative, and we will shame him when he won't. So it's a win-win. I hope that Poilievre will have a majority, because he won't have any excuses in 2029. When the election will come at that time, people will be able to see that the Poilievre government will be like the Harper government in 2011. No reform, nothing. So I'm telling people, vote for something, vote for your values, vote for what you believe. You'll have more chances to have what you want.
100%. You are just my favorite politician in Canada. And every time you speak, I can't find something that I disagree with, right? So why are we not voting with our conscience and with what we truly believe in?
For us, we are doing politics differently. And I want to tell people, it is not a slogan, that's a reality, because we have always the same platform since the creation of that party until we win the battle of ideas.
Wow. Thank you very much, Maxime, for who you are, what you do, and for being a very, very courageous person.
Thank you, Laureline. Thank you very much. Have a nice
day. You're welcome. You too. Bye-bye. I have to tell you that Maxime Bernier is not only a very kind and wise, common sense person, as you see him when he's on air. He just is that. He just is that, and he's just real. And I don't know what has compelled him to fight so hard, but he says, because it's right. It's just right.
And what a coincidence. Right now, it just so happens that you are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. I recall when Maxime Bernier first attracted my attention as someone who was a principled politician. He was a guest on CJBK Radio's Andy Utman talk show, and Andy asked Bernier about his quote-unquote libertarian views. To my utter shock and pleasant amazement, and I'm paraphrasing here, Bernier replied that he doesn't necessarily object to the libertarian label, but that he prefers to be seen as an advocate of freedom instead. And I agree with Laura Lynn. Bernier is the real thing. Perhaps the most honest and principled politician I've ever met outside of my own Freedom Party sphere of influence. And of course, he's been a guest on Just Right on several occasions. And then there's Walter Block and Marie Rothbard. How ironic that Rothbard and I were the only two speakers at the inaugural dinner announcing the formation of the Freedom Party of Ontario at an event held at the Royal York Hotel in Toronto. That was in late 1983. Because of my successes at organizing and recruiting members and supporters in the London area, I had assumed the provincial presidency of an officially registered political party in Ontario called UnParty, which was formed by a group of disaffected libertarians who had abandoned the Libertarian Party. My first act as president of that party was to change its name to Freedom Party, a change that officially took place on January 1st of the Orwellian year 1984. And when we released our issue paper stating that the purpose of government is to protect your individual freedom of choice and not to restrict it, just about every libertarian in the party abandoned us. Purpose of government? Are you kidding? Libertarians hated the idea that government had any purpose at all, something quite consistent with libertarian anarchism, in which no government is the ideal. However, in the case of Walter Block, he had no problems whatever working with Freedom Party, and over the years gave several presentations at Freedom Party events, and had several of his essays and articles published in Freedom Party newsletters and publications. Walter was then the senior economist at Vancouver's Fraser Institute, and he first introduced himself to me after hearing me deliver a speech at an event hosted by Landlords Against Rent Control in Toronto. Even though we haven't been in touch for years, I still regard Walter as a long-standing friend. But when Walter said that he became a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist after being presented with the prospect of privatizing the post office, privatizing the public library, sanitation, the cops, the courts, I have to express my complete disagreement with and opposition to anarchism. Sure, I can agree with privatizing the post office, libraries, and sanitation, but I do not agree with privatizing the cops and the courts. And as if to illustrate the incredible degree of disagreement and division that exists within the libertarian movement, it was my great honor and pleasure to have met and gotten to know the very first libertarian U.S. presidential candidate, John Hospers, when he appeared in London, Ontario to speak at the International Society for Individual Liberty back in 2000. Personally, I was utterly shocked and quite pleased to hear a past leader of the Libertarian Party speak out against some of the most basic tenets of libertarianism, as he did in this brief excerpt from that speech.
Ayn Rand thought that nations had a limited function to provide armies, police, and courts for the protection of individuals in each nation. Many libertarians, as you know, have said that giving governments this much is already a betrayal of individualism, that since all governments are coercive and we are committed to minimizing coercion in the world, that's often given as a definition of libertarianism, the only proper procedure is for each individual to provide for his or her own defense. There would be defense agencies a la David Friedman, which you could join or not as you wish, each competing for the privilege of defending you for pay. I confess that I'm afraid of competing defense agencies for the same reason that Thomas Hobbes was 350 years ago. He was skeptical about having more than one enforcement agency in a given geographical area. Competition in consumer goods? Yes. Competition in arms? No. More than one enforcement agency in the same region? He called that civil war.
John Hospers passed away at age 93 on June 12, 2011, and I'll never forget his final post to Just Right's Facebook page only a few months earlier. Quote, "Not right wing, just right, nice," end quote. Hospers was not an anarchist because clearly he supported having a government to maintain armies, police, and the courts. As a Libertarian Party leader, he was just about the exact opposite of the Libertarians' current party leader, who's gone completely woke. Now, my Funk and Wagnalls dictionary defines anarchy like this. 1. Absence of government. 2. Lawless confusion and political disorder. And 3. General disorder. And it describes anarchism as the theory that all forms of government are incompatible with individual and social liberty and should be abolished. Whereas, Tom Burnham's Dictionary of Misinformation defines anarchism this way, quote, "Entirely in contrast to the popular conception, anarchism is probably the most idealistic and peaceful of political theories. As a philosophy, it assumes a system in which the individual is free and living in peace. It looks forward to a time when human beings can coexist within a framework of voluntary associations. It is in no sense either Marxist or Leninist. Anarchism, in fact, rejects the Marxist-Leninist theory of the dictatorship of the proletariat as it rejects any theory involving control of one class or individual by another," end quote. Well, it's utterly beyond my comprehension how Burnham can even refer to anarchism as a political theory that, quote, "assumes a system." I mean, what the hell is that? What kind of theory operates on assumptions about some undefined and unnamed system? And then there's the conservatives, who exist with their own set of contradictions and misrepresentations. As Maxime Bernier pointed out, "I hope Polyev will have the majority, because in 2029 he'll have no excuses, just like the Harper government. No reform, nothing." Well, it turns out that the reason that conservatives have never reformed government in the direction of individual freedom is because that's not what conservatism or conservatives are all about. And here is Stephen Harper himself confirming that fact back when he was Prime Minister of Canada.
"And an older form of liberal, who we now sometimes call libertarian, believe that the solution to all problems lay in less government. Now, individual freedom is something we as conservatives value. But it is not the only thing we value, because our value system, like reality, is a bit deeper than that. I like to summarize my idea of conservatism in three F's: freedom, family, and faith. Individual freedom is one of our fundamental values, but freedom must be tempered by faith, or more broadly, by what faith in all its forms teaches, that there is a right and wrong beyond mere opinion or desire. freedom must be used well. To conservatives, it cannot be just about freedom.
Now, where did we hear this argument before? Well, on the debate between Bruce Pardee and David Haskell, who argued that a Christian political philosophy should be applied to the governing of a country. Harper was spewing the usual conservative contradictions, which is why we often called the Conservative Party the Contradictories. You cannot rationally argue that you value individual freedom in the same sentence that says freedom must be tempered by faith. In other words, freedom is not on our agenda, and the proof of that is the way they've refused to govern in favor of freedom ever since I've known conservatives. Libertarians believe that the solution to all problems lays in less government, says Harper. Ironic, since conservatives themselves have used the slogan, more freedom through less government. The real problem that no one seems able to identify is that we currently live under a condition of no government at all, and that is why we have less freedom. Freedom requires government, and anarchy ensues whenever true governing vanishes. If I were to describe the state of Western culture today, I would call it anarchistic. Exactly as defined in the dictionary, an absence of government, lawless confusion, political disorder, general disorder. Until more people who regard themselves as conservatives, or libertarians, or anarchists, or right-wing, begin to use definitions that are correct, their proposed solutions for defeating the woke ideology, let alone for achieving freedom, will always be ineffective and lead in the opposite direction. As Isabel Patterson always reminded her readers, when we speak of government, force is what is governed. Both left and right are competing polarities with regard to the legal use of force. The left resorts to the use of initiatory force for whatever it wants to do, from providing social benefits to imprisoning and locking people up unjustly. Whereas the right, and here I mean the true right, those who are just right, resorts to the use of defensive and retaliatory force in the protection of life, liberty, and property. Now, coming up next, Jimmy Dore in conversation with Scotland's Neil Oliver on why Oliver thinks that politics is dead and on why being just right is so feared by those who aren't.
There's a general election coming up.
Yes.
In July, most of us are talking about the fact that it's a uniparty, that what used to be the Labour Party, which was socialist, what used to be the Conservative Party, which was conservative, it's now two cheeks of the same arse. And you can't tell the difference between them. There's massive, massive voter apathy, I would have thought. I can't believe that mainstream journalists are still going through the pantomime of interviewing people from the Labour Party, people from the Conservative Party, people from the Liberal Party, people from the Scottish National Party, as though these people were anything but sock puppets. they're just utterly empty. They're devoid of character, devoid of personality. You know, there's no conviction, there's no meaning. Politics is dead. Politics is dead in your country also. The Republican, Democrat, who cares? I don't know what the solution is, but politics is dead and democracy is gone in our countries at the moment. That's just where we are.
And now they're trying to absolve all their past sins. And the people who aren't trying to absolve their past sins are trying to memory hole them like, oh, COVID's over. Let's move on. Yeah. What do you have to say about that?
Memory holding is right. One of the most sinister aspects to this, and the thing that has me most enraged at the moment, is the number of the people that were pushing it, that were cheerleaders for it, that were instigators of it, that were helped to choreograph it and led it on and did all the shaming and the ridiculing and the name calling and all of the rest of it. And they think that it's already time that we've all forgotten. I find, as you say, with someone like Chris Cuomo, who seems to think that nobody kept receipts, that nobody kept recordings of things that were said just a couple of years ago. The idea that they can already absolve themselves of all sin and pretend that they were on our side of the line the whole time without at any moment pausing to draw breath and say, I really messed up massively. They've just jumped the fence and they're now pretending that they were here promoting the efficacy of ivermectin and encouraging people to my body, my choice all along. That's the sinister bit. It's how quickly they think that everyone has forgotten. I think many, many people who took the products And many people did it to keep their jobs, and because they were genuinely frightened, and because they really thought that they were doing the right thing, and because they had been persuaded that it was the right thing for their communities and all of the rest of it. I think so many of those people just can't believe that they did it, which is understandable. And so there is a big appetite out there to forget and move on. But I think it's absolutely beholden on people like us to say, no, there's a stage we've got to go through, and it's owning up, taking responsibility, accepting responsibility, and acknowledging what was done. The COVID experience showed so many people that actually, when the single choice of their generation came down the line at them, they were Gestapo. They were ready to don the uniform and kick the doors in. And I think that's an incredibly difficult realization for people. There's an enormous reckoning that has to be lived up to and lived through and accepted. And unless and until that happens, people like me are going to keep on banging on and banging on and saying, no, we were there. It's all on record, what you did, what you said. It's incumbent that there just be enough of us that say, no, we remember exactly what happened, who said what, and the consequences that need to apply.
All those people, I don't know if it was like that in Scotland. If you question it, you were considered a right-wing conspiracy theorist, crazy. Is that what happened?
By now, Jimmy, I mean, 4 years in, because it started with COVID. I started for the first time really in my life. I spoke out about COVID, but then I've spoken out about everything else since. You know, I've spoken out about the Ukraine war. I've spoken out about what's happening in Gaza. I've spoken out about the climate hoax. You know, I'm a way out where the buses don't go. And I've been called everything. You know, I've been an aluminium hat-wearing crank. I've been an anti-vaxxer. I've been a granny killer. I've been a Putin apologist. I've been I've been anti-Semitic. You know, I've had everything labelled at me. But to be quite frank, 4 years in, if you're not being abused in that way, or if you haven't been the subject of that kind of flack, then you're not in the fight. You're not in the game. It's a badge of honour to be treated in this way. And it's worth remembering anyway that no good deed goes unpunished. That's just a fact of life that predates all of this. You know, people are in a hurry to forgive themselves and to forgive each other for the sins that were committed. But what will never be forgotten and will never be forgotten, what will never be forgotten and will never be forgiven, are the people who were just right.
They called
it right.
Well, we're not looking for forgiveness, but it's nice to know that we won't be forgotten. In contrast to Neil Oliver's contention that politics is dead, I would argue that it's not politics, it's the left that is dead. And that includes all of its right-wing adherents as well. And remember, even if they are two cheeks on the same arse, there is still a split between them. And as for the death of politics, here's Paul Joseph Watson with a brief update on political developments in Europe.
Lefty losers got trounced in elections all over Europe. In Austria, the Freedom Party scored its first ever election victory, gaining nearly 26% of the vote. This off the back of a campaign firmly rejecting net zero insanity, mass migration and alphabet people indoctrination. The establishment was shaken to the core, bemoaning once again that democracy was under dire threat because people democratically voted for candidates they don't like. When around a third of the continent is voting for parties labelled far right, and 70% of Europeans think their country takes in too many immigrants, at what point do they acknowledge they're not far right? They're just right!
So, maybe being just right is the key to ultimate political success. And consider this, all of you wasted vote theorists. Austria's Freedom Party was only recently regarded as one of those third parties on which your vote would be wasted. Something to think about, at least until you join us again next week when we will continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
But Americans are not struggling. You know, this is the worst platform. Who put this stage up here? This is the frickin' place is falling down. I notice it keeps tilting further left.
like too many other things.